You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, my old friend Jim Riva, who wrote one of my absolute favorite books, has a new book out. It's called Magic in the City, a San Francisco story. You can find it over at jimriva.com. It's just an e-book, jimriva.com. Just an FYI. I read half of it last night. I just got it on my phone, and I read it on the Kindle reader on my iPhone. It's April Fool's Day, so Carl in the morning on X-Ray FM in Portland, Carl Wolfson, just did this hysterical skit about Scalia has resigned. He's got audio, you know, and Cheney has been indicted, and Bush is better him than me, and it's just, unfortunately, we didn't, not unfortunately, whatever, we're too sober here, didn't really put together a good April Fool's Day gag for you, but the Republicans did, right? I mean, you know, in to help us out, Paul Ryan is officially releasing his budget today, and he's going to, you know, hey, you know, let's voucherize Medicare and let's cut Social Security and let's dial back even the age at which we're going to grandfather people from 55 to 56, and let's screw the, you know, young people and students and student debt and to hell with them but the billionaires, inheritances, taxes on rich people, taxes on banksters. Oh, man, he's all over them. So, you know, once again, the Republicans, the only thing I can think of to call it is a bad April Fool's joke. So, anyway, that's going on. There's a lot in the news, even some about the missing plane and a few, the CIA report. We're going to get into all these things as we go on through the day. But I had a conversation earlier today with Jimmy Carter. And he's got a new book out. It's called A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. I've read a little more than half of it, and it's brilliant. Strongly recommend you get this book, Jimmy Carter, A Call to Action. And most of you are familiar with the clip. Do we have time? No. Okay. I'll play the clip later. But most of you are familiar with the clip where Lyndon Johnson is talking with Everett Dirksen. And he says, you know, the Nixon campaign is telling Madam Tu over in South Vietnam not to do this peace deal that we worked out. This was in 1968 when it was Nixon versus Humphrey. And LBJ had negotiated peace with South Vietnam. And so I'll play the clip for you later. I should have played it for the president, for President Carter, because this was how I opened the interview with him. I'm very pleased to welcome back to our program the man that I consider the best president of my lifetime, Nobel Peace Prize winner, one of our world's genuinely great statesmen, former President Jimmy Carter. He has a new book out called A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. President Carter, welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's good to be on with you and all folks all over the country.
Thank you so much. Before we get to your book, which I have read most of, and I think it's absolutely brilliant, I have an unrelated question about American politics.
Okay.
Do you mind if I ask that, or would you prefer
I don't mind.
It's okay?
Yeah.
In about three or four years ago, the LBJ Library released tapes of LBJ working with Everett Dirksen trying to stop the Nixon campaign in '68 from blocking LBJ's peace deal with South Vietnam. They were not successful, and Dirksen called what Nixon did treason, and those tapes are now available. President Bonnie Sauter said that something similar happened to you during the Reagan campaign, and George W. Bush was only president because of the intervention of the U.S. Supreme Court, something you've commented on in the past. I'm wondering, you know, have we had a legitimately elected Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower?
Well, I think so. I wouldn't want to comment on that. That's pretty gross. But, yeah, I think we've had a legitimate elected president. I don't think that George W. Bush won the election in 2000 against Al Gore, because I think that he probably lost Florida and also that nationwide. But, you know, when the Supreme Court rules in our country, that's what we have to accept.
Yeah, I absolutely. In your book, your book is so extraordinary, and I just want to strongly encourage all of our listeners to pick this up. It's a short, easy read, and it's so solid, a call to action. Early on in the book, in page 35, you talk about how America has dropped the ball, how incarceration, for example, you said when I was president, you're talking about now, you know, there are now five times as many American inmates in federal, state, and local prisons as when I was president. The number of incarcerated black women has increased by 800%.
That's correct. Yes, in fact, when compared to when I was governor, there's seven and a half times as many people in prison now. We've gotten to be a punitive society rather than a rehabilitative society, and we also have the only death penalty, as you know, in this hemisphere or in NATO. And those things, I believe, are excessively violent, and they don't depend on making people better if they do make a mistake in the law. And there are about 3,200 people in this country now who are in jail for a life sentence that have never committed any crime of violence. They're there for drugs and so forth. So this is what we are doing in our country, and I think it sets a bad example for demonstrating violence in other aspects of our life.
As a Christian, you quoted a conversation you had with, I believe it was an Orthodox Christian, or was it the Vatican? I'm sorry, I read it. I don't have it right in front of me.
Right.
Where they talked about how man was created first, but then with the, in the Christian context, men and women are created equal, basically through baptism.
Yes.
And that you see that as a really good sign in that realm. Could you speak to that and also to the later story that you told about how the King of Morocco came back to the White House and spoke with your mother and how he's opening up Morocco to women? You mentioned Saudi Arabia, some of these countries that we think of as very restrictive, and in many ways they are, how the Muslim world is changing as well.
Well, I think the Muslim world is not to be condemned because, as I mentioned, a whole lot of maybe about 20 countries in the Islamic world that have very honest and fair elections. In fact, the largest Islamic country in the world is Indonesia, where we've had two elections at the Carter Center monitored. And in Morocco, the young king who came to visit me at the White House when I was president, he was just a boy then, has made the most profound changes or reforms in their laws in Morocco than any other country in the Islamic world as far as guaranteeing women equal rights. And this is a very encouraging thing. But I wouldn't say that the Quran has any worse verses in it about women's rights than does the Holy Bible. In fact, it's hard to find a verse in the Quran that really says that men are superior to women. Almost invariably, the verses say that they're both created equal in God's eyes. But in the Christian church, of course, and in the Old Testament, you can find some selected verses that say the opposite thing. But I teach the Bible every Sunday in my little home church in Plains, and I know that Jesus Christ was a preeminent champion of women's rights in his lifetime and maybe the champion of all times. So when I get into a quandary about a particular verse in the Bible, there are about 36,000 of them, I just go back and read what Jesus did and said, and it reassures me about women's rights.
Mm. So we'll continue with our conversation with President Carter that we recorded just a few hours ago after the break. But and that first part where I asked him if there's ever been, you know, since Eisenhower, if we had a legitimate elected Republican president. We put that up on YouTube at youtube.com/Tom Hartman this morning, along with the clip, which I will play for you when we come back, of Lyndon Johnson talking with Everett Dirksen about the treason that Richard Nixon committed. And, of course, President Carter is well aware that President Bonnie Sauter, the former president of Iran, is running around saying that Reagan cut a deal with Iran to hold the hostages. And so I think it's still an open question.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But all that said, all that political stuff said, Jimmy Carter's book about women, religion, violence, and power is brilliant. It's called A Call to Action. Strongly recommend. Welcome back. Nate Sweet is with us, international television superstar and producer with The Big Picture. Hey, Nate.
How's it going, Tom?
And conservative commentator.
So, April Fool's on that, conservative commentator.
Well, tonight you get to play that role. It's you and Huey and Laurie Sanders. Has Laurie been on the show before?
Yeah, she has, but she was on a few months ago. She was good. She's great in politics panels.
Good, good. You know how terrible I am with names and faces. So. So I thank you for the tip. So some of the topics we're going to cover.
So on the politics panel, we'll be starting off by talking about Obamacare's big day. Over 7 million people have now signed up for healthcare under the through the insurance exchanges under Obamacare, which is obviously big news for the administration. That's the original goal set out by the CBO back in October when the exchanges first opened. So obviously some interesting news and potentially politically damaging news for Republicans and politically advantageous news for Democrats. So we'll be breaking into what that
means. There's an interesting piece on that. When I sent you back a note earlier our setup, I went looking for it. In fact, I spent almost 10 minutes looking for it. It has scrolled off the board. It was over on Democratic Underground early this morning, like maybe 7:30 when I got up, and I was just browsing around, and I couldn't find it again. But basically what happened was Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's head of the Democratic Senate Congressional Campaign Committee, she was on some local radio show, and the host said, if you could do one thing to fix Obamacare, what would it be? And she said, well, I'm not really sure. There are some things that need to be fixed. It's not a perfect bill, but, generally speaking, I think it's working well. And then what happened was, this was apparently yesterday, and in very quick succession, in a whole bunch of different conservative media, and my recollection is that, it was Fox News and then all the usual right-wing websites and radio shows, but they had the quotes on there. Debbie Wasserman Schultz admits Obamacare not perfect. Debbie Wasserman Schultz says Obamacare needs repair. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, it's so bad I'm not even sure where to begin. All this kind of stuff. And the point of the post was, we need to stop giving Republicans this kind of stupid ammunition and just start saying, and this I think is what Bill Clinton was saying a couple of days ago, just start saying, this is a damn good start. So, anyhow, end of rant. Back to you, Nate.
No, and I mean, I think that's how a lot of people were thinking it when this bill was first signed. A lot of progressives, definitely people who wanted a single payer system or a public option, were frustrated when it first came out. But there are a lot of ways in which it's much better than the alternative, and you want to preserve, the reforms, the good reforms that Obamacare has made, and the only way you can do that is by pushing for it in the eyes of the public. So that's sort of the situation Democrats and progressives find themselves in right now.
Yeah, I mean, the flip side of it is the weird kind of awkward situation of here we are as progressive Democrats pushing a program that the Heritage Foundation came up with and Mitt Romney put into place.
Right.
But anyhow, back to you.
Republicans were a lot more progressive back then, too. So who knows?
Well, back in the 70s when Nixon first proposed it, actually, yes.
So, maybe it is a progressive program if we're looking to have how much the political spectrum is skewed.
You're great at making lemonade out of lemons, Nate.
And then further on the politics panel, we'll also be talking about Paul Ryan's new budget, sort of more of the same. It has, a repeal of the Affordable Care Act. We'll be talking about the CIA's torture report. New reports out of the Washington Post suggest that the CIA totally misleads the American public and most people in Washington about the success of that torture program. It actually did not lead to catching Bin Laden at all. We'll be talking about the Sheldon Adelson primary that happened over the weekend, sort of what it shows about the royalism that exists in American politics these days. We talked about the share of wealth owned by the 1.0.
Okay, we're running out of time here. But there's lots more coming up on the show tonight. And Nate's going to be on it, so don't miss it. Thank you. Welcome back, 20 minutes past the hour. Okay, so I took too long in my setup before to share with you this clip from Lyndon Johnson. This was in 1968, in the fall of 1968. The Vice President, Hubert Humphrey, is running for president against Richard Nixon. And Nixon finds out, Nixon's people discover, and it wasn't that closely a held secret anyway. I mean, LBJ had been trying to negotiate peace with South Vietnam for several years at that point, found out that they had succeeded. They had reached a peace deal that the North Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese, and the Americans could all accept. And so Nixon sent one of his guys, and in fact, one of the reports I've heard is that actually Spiro Agnew was involved in this, working out of New Mexico, to talk to Madam Tu, one of the big power brokers in South Vietnam, to say, just hold off. And thus Nixon committed treason, according to LBJ. Here's the tape. This was just released a couple of years ago by the LBJ Library.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico. And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. we know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
This is treason. I know. And I really wanted to play that for President Carter this morning, but we had this little 10-minute window, and I did want him to have time to pitch his book. So anyhow, here's the rest of my interview with Jimmy Carter this morning. I'm curious your thoughts on population. I didn't see much discussion of it in the book, although, as I mentioned, I've only read about three-quarters of it. I wrote a book back in 96, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, citing a bunch of research that showed that if you want to stabilize population, it's not even a matter of access to birth control. It's a matter of political and economic power for women, that when women are empowered, they will control family size.
That's exactly right. If you educate girls and women and give them an equal chance in the society, then almost immediately the number of children that they bear drops down. There's a direct relationship between economic progress, and particularly with women, and the small size of families. And we found that we have had programs in about 80 countries around the world, and we found that in every place we've had a major health program.
That as women have power and control over themselves, that their family sizes decrease.
Yeah, and when they know the children are going to live. You know, when they give the children better sanitation, when they give them better diet and so forth, and give them a rudimentary opportunity for better health care, if they realize that their children are going to live, then they don't have as many children as they can. Another thing that happens is that when you convince a community that the girls can get educated and be just as productive when you're an old parent as your son can, maybe even more attentive to her parents, then, of course, you stop the genocide, or gendercide, I call it, of little girls when they're born.
Yeah. It's very easy for us to look at third world nations or other countries and religions and wag our finger at them. But one of the points that you make in the book, and so very eloquently, you talk about not just the Equal Rights Amendment, but the Violence Against Women Act, and then immediately in the next paragraph, how there were a number of prominent politicians and people like Phyllis Schlafly who condemned it. What is your prognosis for women's rights here in the United States? We still have not passed the Equal Rights Amendment.
It's horrendous. We rank 78th in the world in equal pay for women. 77 other countries are above us. We rank 70th. In the number of women who hold public office at the local, state, and level, national level. We have one of the worst sexual trafficking or slavery programs in America, particularly for young girls. The State Department last year estimated that there were 100,000 girls sold into slavery in America every year. Atlanta's the number one trading post for young girls being sold into slavery because we have the largest airport in the world, and we import a lot of our passengers from the Southern Hemisphere, where girls that a pimp wants to buy or brothel owner wants to buy are much more cheap than the girls in the Northern Hemisphere. So we have all of these kinds of abuses, not only in what I've just mentioned, but also in the military and in almost every university in America. We have sexual abuse that's not really punished or even brought to the public's attention.
So there seems in the United States, and presumably all around the world, a number of different leverage points, economic, political, educational, religious. Where are the areas to bring about equal rights for girls and women and empowerment of girls and women that you think are the most powerful and effective, as our last question here?
Well, one thing is for the United States Congress to ratify or approve the laws that have been passed by the United Nations General Assembly and also by the Security Council. There's a convention on the elimination of discrimination against women, CEDAW they call it, that most other countries have ratified, including China and so forth, but the U.S. Senate refuses to ratify this convention. And there's an International Violence Against Women Act that had been passed by most countries. And again, the United States Congress refuses to pass it. And so these are the things that block our country from taking a leadership role in the whole world in trying to reduce the abuse of women and girls.
Okay. President Jimmy Carter, his new book, A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. Sir, you are genuinely one of my heroes. Thank you so much for being with us.
I've been with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
It's one of the last good men in politics. I mean, he's no longer in politics, but he didn't make $100 million when he left office. He didn't, you know, go off to Japan and give a $200,000 speech, which I think was the first thing Reagan did. He's just, you know, Jimmy Carter is a good man. He's a good and decent man. But beyond that, he was actually a very good president. He was the only president, frankly, I think, in my lifetime, that didn't involve us in any kind of a war anywhere. Which is pretty amazing. Anyhow, we'll be back. I'm curious your thoughts on Jimmy Carter, too. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Particularly given how much effort the Republicans and the, you know, the Reagan legacy campaign, this well-funded promotion, have done to destroy Carter's image. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on your media support group for We the People. Talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program. And as I said, there's a number of things I wanted to get to today. Interesting piece about the changing face of global risk by Nouriel Roubini in his newsletter, the Eco-Monitor, today. He says, a couple of years ago, we were worried about breaking up the Eurozone, debt crisis in the U.S., basically the Republicans refusing to pass, you know, a debt ceiling, a public debt crisis in Japan, maybe deflation. War between Israel and Iran, breakdown of regional order in the Middle East. He says, most of these risks now, not so much. But he does point out that there are some serious risks that we should consider. The conflict in Ukraine, he says, this could lead to a Cold War, which wouldn't be good. Crises in fragile emerging markets. The Fed, he says, if the Fed starts raising interest rates too soon, that will be a problem. And the number one risk that he sees is the risk of a hard landing in China. That's his phrase. You can read all about it at economomonitor.com. 60 Minutes. It's been a lot of years since I've watched 60 Minutes. Every now and then they'll have a segment that's worth watching, and I'll catch it on the web. But so I missed them on this weekend. Pam Martin's over at WallStreetOnParade.com, reporting that they had Steve Croft had Michael Lewis on to talk about his new book, Flash Boys. And it's about, you know, the basically Wall Street being rigged. And in fact, I doubt we'll have Michael Lewis on tonight, but I think we're going to be covering this topic at some length tonight on the TV show. So anyhow, Steve Croft, the 60 Minutes reporter, says, so what's wrong? What's the headline here? And Michael Lewis says, quote, stock market's rigged. United States stock market, the most iconic market in global capitalism, is rigged. And then Croft says, okay, who's rigging it? And Lewis says it's, quote, a combination of these stock exchanges, the big Wall Street banks, and high-frequency traders. So he identifies three parties. And according to Pam Martins over at WallStreetOnParade.com, I mean, you know, this just demonstrating the not just the bias, but the deeply in bed relationship between big America and big media. Because it's all one, you know, their boards of directors are interlocked, Their tax evasion practices are the same. Their monopolistic tendencies are the same. And so you wouldn't expect 60 Minutes to go after the big banks, and you wouldn't expect them to go after the New York Stock Exchange, which has now been privatized and is itself a big corporation and has made this possible, by the way, by selling space to these high-frequency traders who basically get in between you and a trade. If you say, you know, I want to buy $1 million worth, as if you would, right? But there are people who do. if you say I want to buy $1 million of the Apple stock and it's selling for $100, I have no idea what it's selling for right now, so I'm just making up numbers here. And it's selling for $100 on the nose. And, you know, they've got a hundredth or a thousandth or 5/1000ths of a second advance notice that you're going to execute this trade before the trade gets executed. They execute their own trade ahead of you so that your trade costs a hundredth of a penny more per stock, per share of stock, and they skim a little bit off the top. It doesn't sound like much, but when they do it hundreds of millions of times a day, it adds up to billions of dollars. I mean, there are literally guys in Wall Street making billions of the B, billions of dollars doing this. And now, of course, 60 Minutes has done a thing on it, and the FBI is saying, oh, yeah, we've been looking into this for a year. And but actually, I mean, I'm going to sneeze here. I first heard about this. 60 Minutes did a piece on it back 3 or 4 years ago. And we had Nomi Prinz on this program talking about it. We've had a number of people, actually. I've talked about it. This is not news. But the point is, nowhere else in the 60-minute piece do you hear anything about the big banks, the Wall Street banks, or about the New York Stock Exchange. It's all like, it's a couple of rogue guys who've got computers. Right. Dianne Feinstein. It seems like she is sufficiently PO'd with the CIA that she might release the 6,300-page summary report, Senate report, on the CIA's torturing people during the Bush administration and how it didn't do a damn bit of good, and it ruined the reputation of America around the world, and it provided a rationale for repressive regimes around the world to start torturing people and just say, hey, America does it. In fact, we had three people on this program last week who were in an Iranian prison. And when people were being tortured in that prison and they said to the guards, what are you doing? The guards said, hey, you guys do it. Quit complaining. In fact, one of them shamed the guard into stopping torturing somebody by saying, what do you think this is, Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo? It was Guantanamo. What do you think this is, Guantanamo? And the guard was like, oh, yeah, we're Iranians. We're more civilized than that. So particularly if you're in California, you might want to let Senator Feinstein know that you'd be very interested if she were to release that report in what it has to say. But given that she's the chairwoman of the committee, she really represents all of us when it comes to intelligence. So I would think anybody anywhere in the country, if you go to callcongress.org, there's toll-free numbers plus the main number for the switchboard in Congress, and you can call Dianne Feinstein's office or your member of the Senate and say, hey, you know, please encourage your colleague. But these are the and one other thing. This is from Victoria Jones's news notes, Talk Radio News Service, and I think she will be with us later today. Or is it, it's going to be Ellen. Great. Ellen Ratner will be with us. But Victoria Jones, don't ever call her Vicky. Victoria Jones writes, and I quote, GOP winner, imperial presidency, this two-word bumper sticker-ready slogan that encapsulates the Republican criticisms about government overreach through Obama's prolific use of executive action. And then she says, the phrase is popping up all over the place. Meanwhile, Democrats have no unifying platform to run on, let alone a slogan. This is so depressing. So anyway, enough of my rants for the day. There's a bunch of other news that I'm going to get into, but we've got another hour and a half to get through it. Jeff in New Lisbon, Wisconsin, you wanted to comment on Jimmy Carter?
Yes, Tom. He's my favorite president back to even the other to the Republican Ike.
Mm-hmm.
But my only complaints was that he picked Paul Volcker as a Federal Reserve head, and what they jacked up interest rates for homes up to 20%.
Yeah.
And I think that was worse than the people that were held in in custody.
Well, it didn't happen in a vacuum, Jeff. What had happened, what drives inflation is not governments running printing presses. I mean, that's one way to do it, but it's very, very rare. It's very crude, and it takes a large hammer. That's what Germany did after World War I because the Treaty of Versailles was so punitive. But typically what drives inflation is that there are shortages of goods. And when there are shortages of goods, well, sometimes services as well, but typically it's goods. When there are shortages of goods, the price of them goes up. And if they're essential commodities, if they're things that a lot of other things depend on, that it, increase in price ripples through the economy. And then people start demanding higher wages to pay for the higher price on the goods, and then other goods start going up, and you get into this inflationary spiral. And the only way to break that inflationary spiral is for the federal government to raise interest rates, which cools down the economy, which deflates the economy, which breaks the back of inflation. And Jimmy Carter had the bad luck of becoming president right after Richard Nixon had been president, and during the Nixon presidency and Gerry Ford, you had the Arab oil embargo. And the Arab, what happened with the Arab oil embargo was that they cut off oil to the United States. The price of oil went, I mean, I remember gasoline during the Nixon, when Nixon became president, we had three gas stations on the corner nearest our house, three of them on the corner competing with each other, and they were all selling gasoline for 4 gallons for a dollar, 25 cents a gallon, right? 30 cents a gallon. That's what gasoline was selling for. And, you know, by the time of the Carter presidency, it was up to 70, 80 cents a gallon. It was just going through the roof. And because of the Arab oil embargo, and in fact, when Louise and I were living in Detroit in 72, which was, you know, again, the tail end of Nixon, we were living in Detroit in 72 during the embargo, and I remember sitting in line for, you know, 2-3 hours at a gas station to fill up the car, and people were getting in fist fights, people were shooting each other. Michigan had done this odd-even thing where if your license plate ended with an odd number, it was Monday, Wednesday, Friday. If it was an even number, it was Tuesday, Thursday, and weekends. And it was nuts. And so Volcker had to do that. You can't blame that on Jimmy Carter. You can blame that on the Arabs, or on the Arab oil embargo, rather. But that was the thing that marred his presidency. You're absolutely right on that. It was that inflation, or that attempt to, a successful attempt, actually, to control inflation. He had inflation under control by the time, you know, he had to turn the White House over to Reagan. And the hostages being seized, and of course Reagan cut a deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages until after the election. Jeff, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So we might not have liked what Paul Volcker did, but the Fed has two mandates, keep unemployment low and keep inflation low, and he pretty much had to do it. It would have been anybody. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Flo in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Flo. Obama signed the Monsanto Protection Act yesterday?
Well, yeah, I'm worried about this thing that Obama signed into law, this H.R. 933. It protects Monsanto from being sued on the GMOs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a favorite topic of yours, isn't it, Tom?
Well, we've certainly discussed it a number
GMOs.
Of times. I just wrote down H.R. 933 so that I can look it up during a break. I didn't know that particular piece of legislation had passed both the House and Senate, and I didn't know that the president had signed it yesterday.
He signed it. My daughter got it up on the computer,
uh-huh.
And Reuters had the story at first, but I'm pretty upset about our president protecting a multinational company like Monsanto.
Well, what do you expect? I mean, this is the Supreme Court has said that whoever has the most money gets to control politics. Monsanto's got a pile of money. Pardon my, I didn't mean to be flippant at you. I'm very, very upset that our political system has been so corrupted by our Supreme Court.
You know what Monsanto did? I watched a PBS special, 2 o'clock in the morning. Monsanto went into where the farmers were trying to plant regular corn. They went after these farmers, bankrupted them, took them to court. They took all their money. They insisted that they plant their seeds. They bankrupted these poor farmers.
And the tool that they used was that the pollen from the genetically modified corn had drifted in the wind over to the fields of the non-GMO farmers, and they were able to detect the DNA of the GMO, the genetically modified organism DNA, in the farmers' fields who were not buying it from Monsanto, and therefore Monsanto was alleging they were in violation of patent law and had committed a crime. And, yeah, I'm very familiar with that story. It's been going on in the United States, in Canada, in India. Yes.
So I'd like to hear you talk about that more, Tom. very upsetting.
It's very upsetting to all of us. And there's just a lot of stuff in every industry sector in the United States that's going on, whether it's the media sector, whether it's the food big ag sector, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's automobiles, whether it's pharmaceuticals, you name it. You've got corporations who are misbehaving and they're getting away with it because they have because money equals political power now in Washington, D.C., as a consequence of Richard Nixon putting Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court in 1971, Powell steering a series of decisions like Buckley versus Vallejo and First National Bank versus Bilotti, and his memo leading to the creation of things like the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the out and out treason that was committed by Bill Casey on behalf of the Reagan campaign to cut a deal with the Iranians to hold the American hostages, which cost Jimmy Carter the presidency in 1980. And you look at these things and it's like, you know, yeah, the fix is in. I mean, the fix is in big time. The fix is in on Wall Street. This is what I was talking about a few minutes ago. The fix is in here in Washington, D.C. And it's going to stay that way until enough people, until enough Americans get angry enough and awakened enough and active enough and go over to places like movetoamend.org and sign the petition and start in their own kitchens or living rooms a group of people to say, yes, we want to get something done about this. Flo, thank you for the call. Nice to hear from you. This is what we've got to do. It's very simple. This is what we've got to do. 10 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back. I gotta go through the HR 933. By the way, a reminder, there is a petition to petition Senator Bernie Sanders to run as a Democrat in the primary, the presidential primary, the Democratic primary that is coming up in 2016. The primaries have already started. Yesterday was the Sheldon Adelson primary, the eccentric billionaire from Las Vegas, where you had all the serious candidates. I thought it was interesting that Ted Cruz and Rand Paul were not invited, but all the serious Republican candidates. Shelley Adelson got burned last time by supporting wackadoodles, Rick Santorum, a.k.a. So this time he said, okay, that's it, only serious candidates, and I'm going to vet you guys. And so they all came, you know, Jeb Bush, if you think he's not running for president, think again. Jeb Bush showed up. Scott Walker, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio. Let's see, who else was there? Oh, and Chris Christie. And there might have been one or two others, but that's the big four. And they went there and they kissed his ring. And in fact, Chris Christie made the mistake of using the phrase occupied territories when referring to parts of the West Bank that Israel's occupying. And he had to go back and say, oops, no, I didn't. You know, it's all Israel from the Jordan River all the way to the ocean. Sorry, I was wrong. Which is a position that even most Israelis don't take. But Shelley Adelson, that's his purity test. So, anyhow, the point is the Republican primaries have already started. And the Democratic primaries, I mean, everybody's going, oh, it's going to be Hillary. Dominate. Well, maybe not. And even if it is, I think it would be a good thing for democracy if somebody gave her a run for her money. It'll be a good thing for her candidacy, in fact. Because it'll allow her to get an opportunity to get out there and fine-tune her stump speech and get a lot of publicity. You get a lot of publicity from your debates. Right? All those Republican debates that Mitt Romney was in, that helped make Romney, you know, that got him to the point where he could get 47% of the vote. Ironic as that is. And so, anyhow, the petition to get Bernie Sanders involved in this thing is over at Progressive Democrats of America's website, which is pdamerica.org. So check that out. Okay, Billy in Wimberley, Texas, you're going to try and tell me that we shouldn't tax rich people so much? Really?
Well, what I'm trying to say to you is it would be much fairer if we went to a flat tax, and here's where I'm coming from on that. The tax system has been set up over many years with the circus going on there in Washington, and they do tax. You do have a progressive tax system, which taxes people as a percentage of their income higher when you make more money. So the tax breaks were put in there to try to ease that. And I would be happy to see a lot of those tax breaks go away if we would go to something like flat tax.
Yeah, well, A, if you think that any change of the tax code is going to involve getting rid of loopholes as long as corporations and billionaires can buy politicians, I got a bridge in New Jersey to sell you. And when these guys say, give us a flat tax and we'll do away with the loopholes, they're just plain old flat out lying to you.
Oh, now, come on.
No, I'm serious. If you believe that, if you believe that, you know, Billy, seriously, if you believe that, you know, Easter's coming, start looking for the Easter bunny.
Hey, man, that's you know, you're not even having a conversation.
No, I'm being insulting. I'm sorry. That's you're right. But that's how seriously I take those kind of arguments. I really think they are right up there with the Easter bunny. They're right up there with the denying global climate change. But let me ask you a question. You want a flat tax. You want a guy who works at McDonald's or Walmart and makes $15,000 a year. You want that person to pay 20% of their income as income taxes. And you want a guy who, quote, works, end quote, on Wall Street doing high-frequency trading where they've got basically a computer sitting in the back of the New York Stock Exchange. They spend most of their time down at the Plaza Hotel drinking champagne, and they're making $2 billion a year to pay 20% income tax. Do I have that right?
You have that exactly
right. Okay. What is that guy who's making $2 billion a year because he's one of the guys who was able to get the first row of the high-frequency trading? What possible contribution to society is he making that is worth $2 billion a year?
I'll tell you this, Tom. You don't get to make that judgment.
Yes, I do. I'm a citizen of the United States. We are the taxpayers. We are the citizens. And we are the ones who decide what the laws of this country are going to be.
You would say, you would see where the first $50,000 or $70,000 isn't taxed at all. So your $15,000 a year argument on that guy doesn't work.
That's not how flat taxes work, Billy.
Well, that's
you've got
the flat tax plan as I've read them.
If you want a flat tax,
$70,000 is not taxable.
Here's where I'll agree with you, Billy, on a flat tax. Let's make Social Security a flat tax. Right now, it's only a tax on working people and poor people. If you make $5,000 a year, 100% of your income is subject to Social Security tax. You pay 6.3% on 100% of your income. If you make $30,000 a year, 100% of your income. If you make $80,000 a year, 100% of your income is taxed for Social Security purposes. If you make $113,000 a year, 100% of your income is taxed for Social Security purposes. But if you make $1 million a year, $990,000 of your income is not taxed for Social Security purposes. You pay no tax at all on that $900,000 of income if you make $1 million a year.
The system is set up, and that should probably be changed too. But they're all taxes. Everything is taxes. Everything goes into the general fund.
No, it doesn't.
We go into a tax reform thing where we can sit down and have these discussions and talk about a flat tax. With regards to Social Security, there's no upper limit on how much you make that gets taxed. You know, I think that's something that we can talk about. But when we keep throwing things back and forth at each other,
why don't we just do that right now?
About the rich people controlling Congress, and
Billy.
The way
they keep the rest of us in line is by throwing us a bone, whether it's you want gun control, or do you want God on the side of the courthouse, are you in favor of or against gay marriage?
Church and state. Try to stay on the point. We can just take these arguments one at a time.
The point is that it's all about economics. Both entirely for the Republican Party and largely for the Democratic Party. It's all about economics, and they use wedge issues to get us to vote for them.
Gun control isn't about economics, and neither is separation of church and
state. You don't think there's a multi-billion-dollar weapons industry in this country that is funding the NRA?
I'm helping to fund the NRA.
No, look at their budget, Billy. Your donation, your $35 a year is nothing to them. It's absolutely nothing to them. Now, I was an NRA member for a lot of years. It's nothing. The NRA is the lobbying arm of a billion-dollar industry, multi-billion-dollar industry.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Tom Hartmann here with you. Meloise Richardson, this according to the Washington Times, a nice conservative newspaper here in Washington, D.C. Meloise Richardson is the poster girl for vote fraud, writes Robert Knight. The Ohio poll worker was sentenced last July to 5 years in prison after being convicted of voting twice in the 2012 election and voting three times in 2008, 2011, and 2012 in the name of her sister, who's been in a coma since 2003. We have voting fraud in the United States. Horace Cooper is on the line with us. He's an attorney with the National Center for Public Policy Research and the author, where to go here? Here we go. The author of Victims of Voter Fraud, Poor and Disenfranchised Are Most Likely to Have Their Votes Stolen, and the co-chairman of Project 21. Hey, Horace.
Hey, good to be on your show today.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, I will stipulate that Meloise Richardson committed voter fraud. In fact, she's spending 5 years in prison for it, and that probably dozens or hundreds or maybe even thousands of other people have. Are we on the same page here?
Mostly. Okay, sure.
Okay. Will you stipulate that probably every day in America, now this is every 2 years when we have an election, but every day in America, there's hundreds or thousands of people who shoplift?
Sure, yes.
Okay. So why don't we just start putting handcuffs on everybody as they walk into a store?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I like the analogy because we are seeing increasingly new and more draconian steps being taken to prevent the shoplifting problem. Way more stores now are videotaping you at every single place that you're at. They are putting tracking devices on the products that you buy.
Right. And they're making theft-proof packages that you can't, that nobody can open without a box cutter and a chainsaw.
Sell to people, since when you go to buy it, you often use some form of financial record that identifies you. They sell that information to you because they know you're the one who purchased it. Right. You've got actually less freedom when you go to the store now, thanks to all of the shoplifting fraud.
Well, it's not that you have less freedom. It's that you have fewer opportunities to commit fraud or to commit, in this case, theft. Because
some people
I'm starting to make your argument for you.
Some people may not want to carry $3,000 to go shopping and buy what they want with it being kept private. Now, because of all of the fraud that takes place in the retail industry, almost every single activity is measured, and that's what I mean by you've got less freedom.
Right.
That's just a consequence of the abuses.
Okay, so I think my point still stands, though. You're more likely to die of a television falling on your head than you are to be convicted of voting fraud in the United States.
Oh, I think that's highly true. You're more likely to win the $100 lottery ticket if you play the lottery regularly than you are to get convicted of voter fraud.
Right. So why should a state like North Carolina, for example, why should they take a step, or Ohio, or Wisconsin is preparing to do this, why should they take steps that knock literally hundreds of thousands of legitimate voters off the rolls in order to prevent a few dozen or even a few hundred or even in your wildest universe, a few thousand people from engaging in voter fraud when there are other ways to do it that don't involve preventing all those other people from actually even walking into the store in the first place, to take us back to the shoplifting metaphor?
Yeah, except that that's actually not what's happening. The Brennan Center, a Soros-funded group, hasn't been able to substantiate one instance of a lower voter participation rate in the states that have adopted voter ID levels. In fact, in North Carolina, in Texas, in Pennsylvania, in Indiana, in Georgia, all these places, they've actually had an increase in turnout. And the reason they have had that increase is because when you ask people why they don't vote, and we have one of the lowest vote participation rates in the modern world or organized world, is my vote won't count or I won't make a difference.
No, respectfully, that's a bit of a red herring. The my vote won't count or I won't make a difference. That comes along with negative advertising, and that's another thing we can discuss. But your point that voter participation has gone up is in those states that have voter ID laws is quite disingenuous. A, in most of these states, those laws have been restrained or they haven't gone into place or haven't gone into effect.
That's
B,
Indiana.
B, in the fewer they have, population has gone up. So, of course, voter participation is going up.
Wait, the Brennan Center told us that there would be scores, hundreds of thousands of people left out.
And there are. I mean, if you look at Florida,
Georgia has not had
in 2000, 80,000 people got knocked off the voting roll in Florida just weeks before the election.
In a year's time between elections, a 100,000 person growth to cover the fact that they had
an
increase.
And C, you had in the last election, in the last presidential election, which was the last election, you had an African American at the top of the ticket, which was bringing out a larger minority vote. I mean, guys are
no.
People are
the
saying
the Georgia numbers started in 2008, the increase in a great
right.
year,
which was the year that Obama ran for office, right?
A great year for conservatives was 2010, and you had
because President Obama was not at the top of the ticket,
and you had a significant uptick among blacks in Georgia.
But nothing like 2008 and nothing like 2012.
Because you never have that kind of turnout in presidential, non-presidential years.
No, but if you want to break it out racially, you will see that's
what you see is the 2010 number, the 2006 number, the 2002 number. That 2010 number shows a significant spike.
Horace, you guys are so committed to making it harder for people to vote. Why not instead look at things like making voting more transparent? Let's go back to paper. Let's stop using machines that are from private corporations that are owned by Hugo Chavez. If you want, videotape the polling place. You know, just like you do airport security, where you know, if you think somebody's committed a fraud, you can go back and look at the picture of it. I mean, if you like the way it works
absolutely
at Macy's, why not do that at the polling place?
I do not want videotaping in the voting booth.
I'm not talking about in the voting booth. I'm talking about walking up and signing in.
If you want to talk about voter suppression, the government has no right to know whether or not I showed up and get to review that on a later date.
Oh, but they've always known that, Horace. Haven't you voted?
They need to know is that it was actually me.
Horace, have you ever voted? When you vote, you have to sign in.
I just told you.
You don't want that to be?
I'm fine with them knowing that it was me. I am not fine with them being able to digitally assess at any point that's convenient for them, my appearance, my presence, or any aspect about me. That's actually the wrong direction.
But you want them to be able to require you. You are such a fan of big government that you want that government to require you to go find your birth certificate, go get proof that you are who you are and that you live where you are, and take that to a government office and get a government issued ID before you can go and vote. I don't get it. How can a conservative, small government loving guy like you be so in love with big government?
That with get your Medicare support, get your Social Security.
We're not talking about Medicare or Social Security. We're talking about voting.
And if you don't have an ID, you have to get a birth certificate, and you have to produce those in order to get those benefits. And in fact,
we're talking about voting, Horace.
If a theoretical person wasn't able to produce their voter ID, they might not get to vote. What they won't be is denied actual treatment or their prescriptions like Social Security and HHS require today.
So again, you're not answering my question. You love big government so much, you want it
No, I dislike
the
government enough that I'm worrying about it killing people by making these requirements. But if
you're going to change the subject,
if the left hand is going to require something, then the far left hand needs to understand they can't go around criticizing it later.
Okay, I will leave you with the last word. Horace Cooper, attorney and national at the National Center for Public Policy Research, nationalcenter.org. Thank you, Horace.
Good luck.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, you know, Wisconsin's getting ready to do it. Scott Walker was out there talking to Shelley Adelson saying, hey, you know, I'm trying to set this stuff up for you, you know. Doing my best. Give me some money. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Frank in DeSoto, Texas, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Another, this time's the Texas caller that said the direct opposite of the last guy from Rimberley. Two things. First, I wish you had mentioned that when you pointed out the high-speed frequency trading, that one of the best ways to counteract that is what should be the public policy of a transaction tax.
You're right.
Something which we had in America from the 1930s to the 1960s. That's the first point.
Yep.
And then the second thing is that he made the mistake, as many Americans do, assume that all of the subsidies to the wealthy of those are going to be shown up in the tax code. Neil Barofsky, when he was the Inspector General for TARP, pointed out that the guarantees, the amounted to the big banks on the derivatives amounted to almost $29 trillion, or double our national debt. And almost I hear nothing about that from the Tea Party or from even from the left. We should have been screaming about that.
Yeah, I agree.
With the subsidies to the big banks. And then second, their offsets, the subsidies that the Fed gives to the big banks who caused the mess, which is much higher than what a student can get a loan for or for what a community bank can get a loan for. These are not counted.
One out of four, 100 out of 400 of the richest Americans pay nothing in taxes or get money back, and about a third of the largest corporations in America pay nothing in taxes or get money back.
And that's never spelled out. See, those who are talking about the high tax rates almost ignore that. They ignore the fundamental fact that after World War II, when we have in our greatest growth, that corporations paid about 40% of federal income taxes.
Yeah.
And they haven't been able to figure out that since that's dropped down to about 9% in really in effective rates, regardless of what the official rate is, that means that middle-class folks are paying more. And then, one final point, Tom. The guy said that money that would come into the treasurer. We see that these major corporations have $2 trillion, which they've been able to offshore. I saw yesterday in the Wall Street Journal at Caterpillar and Senator Leverett point out that they deliberately kept $2 trillion, well, not them, but all of these corporates kept $2 trillion that money should have been taxed, which was made in America, they put off into their subsidies overseas, when no one is saying much anything about
it. And that's the money, because it's corporate America and they're auditable, that's the money that we know about. I mean, there are estimates that it may be as much as $5 or $6 or $7 trillion that is parked offshore in these tax havens by very, very wealthy families, dynastic families, and multi-billionaires. I mean, it's just...
I'm so glad you bring these up anyway. Thank goodness. God bless you, brother.
Frank, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening to KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Professor, good afternoon.
Hey.
How about this? An executive order by the president ending solitary confinement here in the United States.
I think it would be a brilliant idea.
The United Nations has called it inhumane. The European courts have called it inhumane. The prison guards, particularly in Texas, are against it. Psychologists said it creates more problems than it solves.
Yep.
And it does create a situation of sensory deprivation.
Yes. No, it's a form of torture. I'm absolutely with you, Morris. I'm not sure if that's the sort of thing that the president can do by executive order. I think it's because most of these are state laws. You're going to have to go state by state. Or the Supreme Court could rule that it's a violation of the cruel and unusual clause of the, what is it, 7th Amendment, 6th Amendment, 8th Amendment. Thank you, Shane. But I'm with you, Morris. Thank you for the call. Oh, yeah, voter ID laws make it easier for people to vote. And... you know, I got a bridge in New Jersey to sell you. One that doesn't have any interrupted lanes in it. Increasingly, that Bridge in New Jersey is taking on a brand new residence. It's fascinating. Fascinating. Big sign-up surge for Obamacare, by the way. And basically, if you experience problems trying to sign up for Obamacare prior to yesterday, which last night at midnight was the deadline, if you experience problems trying to sign up, pretty much any kind of problem that you can point to and document, actually, you don't even have to document. You merely have to assert it. I would not encourage anybody to engage in fraud and say that they had a problem when they didn't. It's not the right thing to do. But if you had any problems at all trying to sign up, and a lot of people did, then you can still call the Obamacare number or go to healthcare.gov and sign up and just tell them what your problem was. And they're using very liberal guidelines, making it fairly easy for you to sign back up again if you had a challenge or a difficulty. Or if you thought you signed up and you never got the paperwork. That had happened particularly in the early days to a lot of folks. Charles in Denver, listening on AM 760. What's up, Charles?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the catastrophic insurance that might have been offered before Obamacare.
Right.
And then looking at the policies that are in place with Obamacare, how is some of those not catastrophic insurance? $10,000 deductibles. That's what both my wife and I were looking at, and we were going to be paying about $330 for that. And that was the minimum amount. Yeah. Don't you think a lot of Americans are going to pick that the smallest plan?
Well, no, I don't. I don't think so. None of my employees do. As the employer, we're paying 100% of it. But I don't think so. A and B, if you're paying over $300 a month for a bronze plan, you must be making at least $60,000 or $70,000 a year, right?
But this is the second time that I've been kind of called out as far as like maybe my math's wrong, but I went through an agent.
Right.
We did the math. We barely make over $45,000 a year, and that's what we were offered in
between
Colorado.
The two of you.
Between the two of us, and our $10,000 deductible was what we were actually getting. I swear to you, I'm not lying to you.
No,
I'm all about Obama.
It could be or not. It doesn't matter. I can't deal with the specifics. I don't know them, frankly. What I do know is that, generally speaking, for the vast majority of Americans, whatever they're getting now is a better deal than they were getting before, and in terms of dollars. And what they're getting now is absolutely a better deal than what they were getting before, even in terms of catastrophic care, because on the catastrophic policies, those companies that were offering those catastrophic policies many of them didn't kick in until after $25,000 or $50,000 or $100,000, and they were selling these policies for like $50 a month, that kind of thing. Those companies were notorious for saying to people, once they got sick, we're dropping your insurance. And so, you know, if somebody gets cancer and they get surgery, and then the doctor says, oh, and you also need chemo, the health insurance company says, you know, okay, we're paying for the cancer because, you know, you got us. But we're not paying for anything after that because we're dropping you right now. And they had all these games that they played, and they can't do that anymore. And that's a good thing. So, you know, it's not a perfect program, but it is a damn good start, Charles. And you know, good on Obama for doing it. It's a legacy. I predict that, it, you know, 10, 15 years from now, people are going to look back on him the way they look back on Tommy, what's his name, in Canada, the father of the Canadian healthcare system, as one of the most popular guys. Yeah, Tommy Douglas, as one of the most popular guys in the country. Isaiah in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Isaiah, what's up?
Hey, what's going on, Tom? We all know that the more people turn out, they tend to vote Democratic, and the less people turn out, they tend to vote Republican.
Right.
And this whole voter fraud thing is nothing but a dog whistle for illegal aliens, because conservatives can't get people on their values and their conservative ways of doing things, so they have to decrease the vote. So we all know that's true. Second, my second point, I think that the Democrats should use a phrase or the slogan addicted to the Coke, in reference to the Coke brothers. And if they keep playing that in the reel, I think people will start to get it, because our messaging is definitely not where it needs to be. And we kind of suck at that.
Yeah, I'm with you. And what the Republicans have done is they've come up with memes that reduce large pieces of content into very small frames. and they've been at this for decades, and they're really, really good at it. And the Democrats have not been good at it, and it's a tragedy. But you know, there's five or six Senate races right now where the DSCC, I think it's called the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, is funding ads. I know Mark Begich up in Alaska, I think Mary Landrieu, where the Koch brothers have been funding through various front groups anti-Obamacare ads that at the very end say, therefore call Mark Begich and tell him you hate Obamacare. And what they really are is they're anti-Mark Begich ads, anti-Democrat ads. And so the Democratic Campaign Committee is now running ads saying that the Republicans are addicted to Coke, that these two billionaires from out of state are hiring this actress from New York City to star in these ads that are lying to you. And they're just calling them out. And the Koch brothers are starting to squeal about it. I mean, they're starting to get seriously upset. And they've had to recalibrate their ads. Their ads were actually full of lies. And they thought they'd get away with it. They thought nobody would notice. And the Democrats started making serious noise about it. New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, national media started picking up the fact that these Koch brother ads were filled with lies, and that the actresses, and in some cases the real people, were either lied to or were misinformed or were presenting partial information or presenting information in a way that wasn't genuinely representative of reality. And so now they're running ads that are so plain vanilla. There's a piece either over at Fire Dog Lake or at Daily Kos. I read it at one or the other, where they're showing the latest Koch brothers ad that they're running, you know, now. And basically they've got some guy who says, yeah, I got a trucking company. I don't know anything about this insurance thing, and I'm just totally confused. As if that's the thing that's going to take down Obamacare, right? So I, you know, in some ways I have some optimism. Isaiah, you're right, though. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I don't know how much longer this We Hate Obamacare meme coming out of the Republican Party, it's Nazi Germany, is going to last as more and more people sign up for it. The good, the bad, and the very, very macromastically ugly. Brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, Jimmy Carter. During an interview with yours truly this morning, the former president spoke the truth about who really won the 2000 presidential election and why.
I don't think that George W. Bush won the election in 2000 against Al Gore, because I think he probably lost Florida and also that nationwide. But, you know, when the Supreme Court rules in our country, that's what we have to accept.
It's good to see someone of President Carter's stature tell the truth about one of the biggest crimes against democracy in our nation's history, which I wish more people in the mainstream media cared to listen. The bad. Fox so-called news. During a broadcast of America's Newsroom yesterday, the network aired a completely misleading graphic displaying Obamacare's enrollment numbers. The graphic showed two bars, one representing the Obama administration's goal of 7 million enrollees by March 31, and the other representing the actual March 27 figure of 6 million enrollees. Numbers were accurate, but the graph was clearly not, and it made it appear as though 6 million enrollees was less than a third of the 7 million enrollee target. Fox has since apologized for this mistake, but let's be honest, it never should have happened. And if the network hadn't been called out for its error, they probably never would have issued an apology. And the very, very ugly Pat Robertson. During a recent episode of his show on the Christian Broadcasting Network, the televangelist invited Rabbi Daniel Lapin on to talk about why Jews are so good at money. As if that wasn't bad enough, Robertson then tried to make a joke about Lapin not fixing his car because he's too busy polishing diamonds. Seriously, take a look.
I pay one of the best mechanics around to take care of my BMW. That's what I do. I'd be crazy to take my time doing it myself.
Polishing diamonds, not fixing cars.
Exactly.
Just unbelievably anti-Semitic and very, very ugly. That's pretty incredible. Unless the guy's actually in the diamond business. But, you know, yeah. I thought he was a rabbi. I mean, yeah. That's bizarre. John in Hudson, Wisconsin. Hey, John, what's on your mind today? Okay. Thanks for listening to AM 950, by the way.
Okay, hold on 1 second.
Hey, John, you're on the air.
Sorry. Yeah, I was listening to this
especially Wisconsin. I live in Hudson, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar. I know you're familiar with Twin Cities.
Sure.
But it's 20 miles away from St. Paul.
Okay.
My wife and I moved from St. Paul to Hudson about 4 years ago, and we needed to get IDs, you know, new licenses. I got mine real easily. I had a military discharge paper, but my wife, who she was 52 at the time, she lived in St. Paul her entire life, 20 miles away, had a valid driver's license, and what we had to do was we had to get her birth certificate, which was in North Dakota. We had to get a copy of our marriage license. We had to get a bill switched around so it had her name on it, and I had to vouch for her.
Wow.
And, I mean, we were able to do it, but how many people aren't going to be able to do that?
This is to vote?
No, just to get a driver's license.
Oh, just to get a driver's license.
Minnesota to Wisconsin.
And then once you got the driver, then if you want to vote, you got to have the driver's license.
Yeah, or state-issued ID.
Right.
It's the same thing either way.
Right.
You know, and it's, I mean, we were able to do it. Luckily, it hasn't been until a special session comes up now, if he does it again. They haven't enforced it because it was blocked, but if it does, there's going to be a lot of people that don't have the resources to send away.
Well, or frankly, don't have the need. I mean, you know, I live in Washington, D.C. I haven't owned a car for 3 years, and if I didn't travel a fair amount, I would not bother to renew my driver's license. I mean, why have a driver's license and go through all the hassle and go spend a whole day, you know, standing in line at the DMV and all that other stuff, you know, if you're not going to drive a car? And
the fact is with her driver's license was valid from Minnesota.
Yeah.
And the address is 20 miles away from the DMV we were at.
Yeah.
Only it was across the river. The other thing that WARC is really doing, mm-hmm. and which, you know, I'm a little embarrassed to say, but right now I qualify for Medicaid. Now, I just got a part-time job at the post office, which hours are going to vary. It's probably going to put me above the Medicaid level,
right. But
below 133%. So guess what happens to me?
So you fall into the red state Republican donut hole. You can't get health insurance.
Exactly. No, unless I want to pay
full load. Yeah. Unless you want to pay the rate that somebody making over $79,000 would be paying.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That's nuts.
It's really, I moved from Minnesota to Wisconsin to, you know, be closer to my father, but before he passed. But it's really frustrating moving back here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Scott Walker's doing a really good job of screwing up your state.
Hey, you ain't kidding. Well, thanks. I enjoy your show.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call, John. Thanks again for listening to AM 950. David in Nashville, Tennessee, listening on TuneIn Radio. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, I was listening earlier when the guy was talking about flat tax, and I always cringe at these guys because the middle class gets hosed in pretty much every tax there is. The progressive tax is the only thing they have. I mean, the average guy's house is 60% of his net worth, and he pays property tax. Whereas, say, Mitt Romney's house property is only like 2% of his net worth.
Right.
So the whole middle class is paying more property tax, more sales tax. The income tax is the only thing they have, and the CEOs are getting paid in stock options anyway. You know, so you got average guy has a 401k that's fully taxed at ordinary income, and the rich guy has a stock tax that's capped at 15%.
Yep. Yep.
You know, so
yeah, it's not 20%, but yes.
Yeah, it's the only thing that we have.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, so I think you did a good job mentioning the FICA tax at 117, but there's not a tax that benefits the middle class at all. Everything is stacked to the top.
No, about the only thing you've got are the child tax credits and the mortgage deduction, and those are, you know, relatively insignificant in the grand scheme of things, and most people don't have enough kids that, you know, the child tax credit means anything anymore.
Yeah, you take a rich guy, if he's got a ton of stock, he dies, his kid gets a step-up in basis, so all the profit on that stock is just disappears.
Right.
You know, there's no tax. I mean, so it's really a top-heavy system. And so when I hear this flat tax, I think, oh, that's the last nail in the coffin.
What it means is the Republicans have found another useful idiot. And I don't mean that in the derisive way. It's because what's so sad to me is that there are so many people who are actually very smart and in a lot of ways. And yet they buy this stuff because, these fellows on the right, these billionaires, they have spent hundreds of millions, arguably billions of dollars over the years, you know, hiring really slick PR people, really good advertising people, really good think tanks that put out, you know, very thoughtful sounding papers. and they get very, you know, very well paid and very polished spokespeople to go on the national news programs and sit around and talk with the other multimillionaires, the people who are making, you know, $2, $3, $5, $10, $15 million a year as a TV star, basically on one of the big three networks or one of the big cable networks. And they're all nodding at each other. Yeah. The rich are paying too much in taxes. And it's a scam. It's just a scam. We've got a plutocracy now, an oligarchy, and it's going to stay that way until the power of money over politics is broken. And that's going to take a change in the Supreme Court or an amendment to the United States Constitution. And I'm not even sure a change in the Supreme Court will be enough. So I'm, you know, this is where I think the last hope for America is movetoamend.org. And I'm not a member of the organization, but in fact, one of the reasons that I don't have any formal relationship with them is so that I can act absolutely with total integrity, say this group is it. These guys are doing, you know, they're doing God's work in this country. This is the stuff that needs to be done. David, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. A quick question about LBJ and a comment for some of these what I call yes but right. Repo party callers, like the gentleman who thinks the flat tax is progressive.
Right.
These are the same kind of folks who like called your program a few weeks ago and told one of your fill-in hosts that Barack Obama was a big waste of greenhouse gas because he took a jet one day and Michelle waited and took a separate plane. But they forget that Ronald Reagan, when he was in office, he let those solar panels on the roof of the White House go. He didn't do anything.
He just let them go. He took them down.
Bring them back in service.
He just
all
yeah.
kinds of wasteful things, but they don't get called out on it.
Yeah.
So right there, that tells you all you need to know about where they really are at.
I think you're right. And I was just looking for some more of the, I think I've got a folder here with some more LBJ audio in it, because there was a series actually of those things. Oh yeah, this is an interesting one. This is LBJ talking about the war and how just ripped up he was about the war, and this is part of why he worked so hard to try to negotiate peace on this thing. I don't know if I've got time to play the whole thing, and it's not coming up. I'll have to do it after the break. We'll do it after the break. Anyhow, Johnny, thanks a lot for the call. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And you know, not only that, the taking down the solar panels in the White House is the smallest part of the crime against, you know, the American people that Ronald Reagan did with regard to energy policy. The biggest part is that Jimmy Carter had in place tax credits for people who winterized their homes, solarized their homes, made their homes more efficient. And so you've got houses all over the United States that were built in 1978, 79, and 1980, to the years that these tax credits existed, and then it just stopped. You can't travel in Israel without finding houses that have solar collectors on the roofs. I mean, they're everywhere. And the first time I was in the Middle East was in the late 1970s, and it was going on. And it's not, obviously it's not just Israel, but there they were aggressively funding that in part with U.S. tax dollars, with the foreign aid. They're everywhere. But Reagan stopped.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back in a few minutes, and I'll share with you some of Lyndon Johnson's thoughts about the war in Vietnam. Okay, let me try and play these clips, Shano, if I can do that. Let me first set a volume level here. How's that? Okay. Well, we'll find out when it plays, right? Okay, these are three clips. The first is Lyndon Johnson with Adlai Stevenson. The second is Lyndon Johnson with George Bundy. And the third is Lyndon Johnson with Senator Richard Russell. Okay, so this is Adlai Stevenson.
Over there.
Oh, that's way too loud. This is May 27th, 1964.
Over there. That'd be fine. And you be thinking about it. I want to have some talks with you. And if you get free, just pick up the phone and call me during the afternoon sometime.
All right, sir. Fine.
I want to. I shudder at getting too deeply involved there, and everybody thinks that's the only alternative.
Well, I've been shuddering on this thing for 3 years, and I'm afraid we're in a position now where you don't have any alternative, and it's a hell of an alternative. and it really gives me the shakes. But I don't know. He was going to give me all the up to date planning.
So they were talking there basically about the Vietnam War, and Adlai Stevenson is saying, let's not go there. We don't want to do that. Here's McGeorge Bundy.
I think we ought to plan that basis. I'll tell you, the more I just stayed awake last night thinking about this thing, the more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell. It looks like to me we're getting into another Korea. It just worries the hell out of me. I don't see what we can ever hope to get out of there with once we're committed. I believe the Chinese communists coming into it. I don't think that we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home and ever get anywhere in that area. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just the biggest damn mess.
It is. So. It's an awful mess.
And we just got to think about it. I look at this sergeant of mine this morning. Got six little old kids over there, and he's getting out my things and bringing me in my night reading and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought about ordering those kids in there, and what in the hell am I ordering him out there for?
One thing that is
Vietnam worth to me. What is Laos worth to me? What is it worth to this country?
Now we
got a treaty, but hell, everybody else got a treaty out there, and they're not doing anything about it. Now, of course, if you start running the communists, they may just chase you right into your own kitchen.
So that's Lyndon Johnson talking with McGeorge Bundy, who, as I recall, was his Secretary of State in 64, was he? We'll have to look it up. But here he's saying, now this is 64. I mean, the war was just like just beginning. And he was like, you know, we're getting into something here like Korea. And he was a national security advisor. And here he is with Senator Richard Russell, who was, major big-time senator.
Well, think about it, and I'll talk to you again. I hate to bother you, but I've just
got to help you. God knows I do, because it's a terrific quandary that we're in over there. We're just in the quicksand up to our very necks, and I just don't know what the hell the best way to do about it.
I love you, and I'll be calling you.
I'll see you soon.
We're in the quicksand up to our damn necks, and I just don't know what to do about it. And this was in 64, these guys were saying. And so in 68, LBJ actually negotiated peace with the South Vietnamese. Richard Nixon's campaign blew it up. And this morning I asked President Jimmy Carter whether he thought that we had had even one legitimately elected Republican president not using treason since Dwight Eisenhower. He kind of punted on the question, as you might imagine. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service and the founder of GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. And, Ellen, I had Jimmy Carter on the show earlier this morning. I wanted to play this clip for him so badly, but it's 28 seconds, and I just didn't, and you have these little, you got these 10-minute windows. But the LBJ Library just released this 3 years ago. This is Lyndon Johnson on the telephone talking with Everett Dirksen, the grand old man of the Republican Party, he had just negotiated. This is 68. This is fall of 68. LBJ had just negotiated peace with the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese, and Nixon comes in and blows it up. It was actually Agnew. Here's the tape.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico. And then he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
This is treason. And Everett Dirksen goes, I know. So Nixon wins an election by treason. Now you got President Bonnie Sauter coming out and publicly saying that he was president of Iran when they cut a deal with Reagan.
And we knew that.
Yeah, and then
we couldn't prove it, but we knew it.
And then this morning, Jimmy Carter on my show said George Bush did not win the 2000 election. So I don't know where we've got a legitimate Republican. Anyhow, I'm talking politics. What's going on in the news?
Well, actually, there is a lot of politics. There were two interesting hearings today in Congress, and one was the Caterpillar hearings. Mm-hmm. And
as in the company, not the insect.
As in the company, right, it is April Fool's, but this is the real company. And it was really interesting to hear how both the Republicans and Democrats approached it. Now, Caterpillar's been accused of basically parking $2 billion that should have gone to their taxes overseas. Senator McCain talked about how much of their business was done in the United States and did the IRS do their job and that kind of thing. Then what's really interesting is Ron Johnson, a Republican from Pennsylvania, he talked about putting tax savings to use. And did the company do this? And you actually spent this money putting people to work.
In China.
I'm sure. And then Volvo, and actually the VP of Financial Services, a woman, Miss Legacy is her name, said that Volvo has a lower tax rate and they're therefore able, Volvo is able to compete with them because they can reinvest in the facility, that the U.S. tax code does not allow the U.S. to, the Caterpillar in the U.S. to compete fairly. And complexity in U.S. tax rates talked about their CFO who does this, and then of course we had Carl Levin that came in with a very different approach. He talked about the number of employees that their Switzerland division have working on parts, 65. Then he said, well, how many warehouses does Switzerland have? Zero. How many warehouses does the United States have for these parts? 10. But Switzerland gets an 85-15 split in terms of the revenue, obviously, so they can keep.
So they're keeping their money overseas.
That's exactly right.
This is the scam. You build an iPhone or something in China where it costs you a dollar to make it. It's going to sell for $100 in the United States. The Chinese division sells it to the American division for $99. The American division shows a $1 profit. The Chinese division shows a $98 profit. They keep the profit offshore so they don't have to pay taxes.
Exactly. And this is, and then Carl Levin said, well, who owns the Switzerland company? Well, it's a wholly owned blah, blah, blah. But, of course, it is owned by Caterpillar. So, I mean, the whole difference in how Republicans and Democrats see things was just totally evident in these hearings.
Amazing.
Now, later on today, there was the GM CEO, who's a woman, who just took the job. And, again, it was not as partisan as the Caterpillar hearings, but very different. Representative Waxman talked about, he was trying to get very specific as to when did General Motors approve of these switches and how come they were manufactured elsewhere. And it is true that the CEO did say that they're trying to figure out whether this is a cover-up or whether this was sloppy. We do know that General Motors did not manufacture these ignition switches. They were done by Delphi Manufacturing.
Were they done by Delphi in the United States? Because they offshored a lot of this.
I don't know the answer. That I don't know the answer to. That did not come up in the hearing, at least the part I was involved in. And then Marsha Blackburn, a Republican from Tennessee, said, really sort of handed this to her, to the CEO, said, you're making changes. This all happened after your watch, et cetera. It was just very interesting the way both Republicans and Democrats handled those two hearings.
Yeah. That sounds fascinating.
Okay, the White House today talked about, the president was meeting with the Red Sox, and Jay Carney wore a Red Sox hat today. He said there's 200,000 people signed up yesterday from the federal states, 7+ million signed up on the federal exchanges. They don't know how many have signed up on the state exchanges. Jay Carney said that he bet that nobody in the room expected them to do as well as they did. Right. He was talking about the press room. He admitted that there was a crummy rollout, as he called it, of healthcare.gov. And he said people have made it clear that they wanted this product and that this is just the first of several enrollment periods.
That's great.
Okay, a couple other quick ones. Secretary Kerry was supposed to go back. He went left the Mideast for a meeting, was supposed to come back and go to Ramallah to meet with Prime Minister Abbas. Did not happen.
And that is because?
Well, apparently because they wanted to join some of the United Nations groups similar to UNESCO, and the United States is opposed.
Oh, that's interesting. That Abbas, the Palestinians.
Right.
Huh. Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
It's always great to see you here in the studio.
Yes.
Thanks for dropping by. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the IPCC just released a report yesterday. They've been meeting in Tokyo, if I'm remembering correctly. And they're talking about the possibility of sudden, irreversible, catastrophic climate change, about the economic impacts of all this, some serious stuff. Dr. Michael Mann has been at the forefront of research into climate change for a long time. He's the guy who invented basically the hockey stick. He created the graphic that is known as the hockey stick that Al Gore popularized, although Michael Mann wrote a book about it as well himself. And he is the director of Penn State's Earth Systems Science Center. He's a climate scientist and professor. His website is Michael Mann, MANN.net. And Twitter, Michael E. Mann, M-A-N-N. And Dr. Mann, welcome back to the program, or welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It's always good to talk with you.
Thank you. And the title of your book was?
Oh, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars.
There you go. Hockey yeah. Stick and the Climate Wars. I'm sorry, I didn't have it in front of me, and I have the book. Now, you wrote at least one, it looks like several here. I have a couple of different pieces in Scientific American, unless one must be just a clip of another. Why global warming will cross a dangerous threshold in 2036?
So there was an article both online and in the April print issue, and then there was a supplementary piece that provided a little bit more of the context behind that article.
Aha. Okay. Well, I have them both here. You want to give us the summary of what you had to say?
Sure. So in this piece, what I wanted to address was this notion. It's a false notion, but nonetheless, it has gotten quite a bit of mileage in sort of the fringe regions of the internet, but increasingly in the mainstream media, this idea that there has been a pause in global warming, that global warming has stopped. I call it the faux pause.
We had a congressman yesterday say this on the floor of the House of Representatives, Jim Brindisi.
Oh, it's become a standard talking point for climate change deniers and contrarians and sort of professionals in the disinformation campaign. And so this continues to be repeated, even though it's completely false. And what I wanted to do in this piece is say, well, you know, let's suppose that that there had been a pause in global warming, even though there hasn't been. Let's suppose that because of year-to-year fluctuations, related to things like the La Nina phenomenon. You know, there's the El Nino phenomenon, but we've actually seen more of its flip side in recent years, La Nina. And that's actually cooled the climate a little bit in recent years. It's a natural factor that will soon go away. In fact, we're already predicting a very large El Nino within the next year. But let's assume that somehow we do our best to fit these natural fluctuations in a way that downgrades our estimate of just how sensitive the Earth is to greenhouse gases. So let's assume that all that, you know, that small decrease in the rate of warming somehow indicated that the globe was less sensitive to greenhouse gas increases than the, you know, scientific community generally considers to be the case. Well, it turns out that if you make that concession to the deniers, it turns out it buys us about 10 years, that we would cross that 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degree Fahrenheit, often characterized as a dangerous threshold of global warming and climate change. We would cross that threshold 10 years later, 2046 rather than 2036. So, in fact, even if you make that concession to, you know, climate change contrarians, it turns out it doesn't lessen at all the threat that we are faced with, the prospects for potentially dangerous and irreversible climate change that you know, that we'll have to deal with if we don't do something about the problem now.
This, whether it's 20 years down the road or 30 years down the road, this threshold, this temperature threshold, by rounding it off to round numbers, degrees C, seems a little arbitrary. Wouldn't it be, or perhaps this is how we talk about it in public, wouldn't it be more useful to identify specific feedback loops that at a certain point become self-reinforcing and thus unstoppable? And how many of these do we need to aggregate before we've got a serious problem? And where are we relative to that?
Yeah, indeed. And in fact, that's part of, you know, the uncertainty. You'll often hear from contrarians the notion that uncertainty somehow lessens the threat. But in fact, as you've just alluded to, the uncertainties could very well, in fact, more likely will work against us, that the problem may be worse than our best models currently project, because there are potential what we call feedback mechanisms, but these are vicious cycles that we set in motion when we warm the climate. We release some of the methane that had been frozen in the permafrost, and methane itself is a powerful greenhouse gas, so we get even more warming. And we don't know precisely how much of that stuff is out there. It's somewhere in the domain of either the known unknowns or the unknown unknowns when it comes to the issue of, you know, potential aggravating climate change factors. So
you and Don Rumsfeld.
Exactly. You know, it happens to be a good characterization of what we're dealing with here. You know, things that we know are missing from the models and potentially make the model projections too conservative, and those things that we haven't even thought of but still loom out there. And those are the things that keep us up at night. And so, frankly, the 2 degrees Celsius warming threshold is somewhat subjective, but we know that even taking the most conservative estimates, 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet relative to pre-industrial over a time scale of one century will almost certainly exceed the adaptive capacity of natural systems of other animal species and of us. We haven't had to deal with rates of climate change in our entire evolution. We haven't had to deal with rates of climate change as large as what we're dealing with potentially right now. And so that number is actually a conservative number, and it really isn't like there's a cliff. It isn't like, you know, we drive up to the 2 degrees Celsius cliff, and, you know, if we go over, then there's nothing left we can do about the problem. I like to use the analogy of, you know, a highway that is ever sloping downward, steeper and steeper, and we're going farther and farther down that dangerous highway. And you know what? We've probably missed the 400 parts per million CO2 threshold. That doesn't mean that we don't try to get off at the next exit ramp, you know, the 420 ppm threshold. And if we miss that one, we take the next exit ramp. The problem is, the farther we go down that road, the greater that downslope of that highway, the worse impacts we commit to.
We're adding about 3 ppm per year, right?
That's right. And so if you do the math, we just passed the 400 parts per million CO2 last year for the first time. We're fairly certain that you have to go back millions of years to find CO2 concentrations that were that as high as what we've now reached. That's how unprecedented this experiment is, this uncontrolled experiment that we are playing with the climate. And if you do the math, at 3 parts per million CO2 per year, we reach that 450 parts per million level in a matter of decades. And that will almost certainly commit us to greater than 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming, and likely exposes us to the risks of some of those feedback loops, some of those vicious cycles kicking in and making the problem even worse, and committing future generations to essentially irreversible changes in our climate.
That's remarkable. We're talking with Dr. Michael Mann. I understand you can be with us for the half hour.
I'm looking forward to it.
That would be great. Please stick around. We will be back with more of our conversation with Dr. Michael Mann, climate scientist, professor, and director of the Penn State Earth Systems Science Center, the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, and his new piece out in Scientific American, Why Global Warming Will Cross a Dangerous Threshold in 2036.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And his website is Michael Mann, with two N's at the end, MANN.net. We'll be right back. And welcome back. And Dr. Mann, just I don't know if Sean explained all this to you. Right now, our commercial stations around the country are in commercial break.
Sure.
And that's a little less than half of our total listenership. But we're still on the air with our Pacifica stations, and we're still live on television, on Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems all over the country. And so when we'll hit another break in 4 minutes when we rejoin the commercial stations, and I'll just very quickly recap whatever you say for those listeners who missed that.
Sounds great.
The concept of a lag time, I've seen this in a variety of different ways, you know, expressed in different ways. I've seen formulas for it. I've seen speculation about it. I don't know to what extent it's solid or nailed down. I've heard people say that the reason why the Earth isn't as warm as you would expect it to be at 400 parts per million, or as warm as it has been in, you know, millions of years ago at 400 parts per million, is because it takes 10, 20, 30, 40, maybe 50 or 60 years for that, for the impact of that. You know, it's like, you know, to be distributed around the planet. What is the lag time? How, if we were to stop right now and freeze at 400 parts per million, how long will the Earth continue warming before it plateaus out and we see that the essential consequence of 400 parts per million?
Yeah, and so you're right. You know, the climate is like a steaming locomotive right now. And if we slam our foot on the brakes, it doesn't come to a stop immediately. It may take a mile down the tracks before we come to a stop. That's because of the inertia, the weight of that locomotive. Well, the climate system has what we call thermal inertia. The oceans have a huge capacity to absorb heat. And so what's happening is a lot of the warming thus far, a lot of the heating of the planet is still penetrating down into the ocean, into the upper parts of the ocean and eventually the deep ocean. And that heat will continue to penetrate into the ocean for centuries. And so the surface of the oceans won't reach a new equilibrium, won't fully respond to the greenhouse gases we've already put into the atmosphere for many decades down the road. It's what we call the committed warming. So the Earth will continue to warm up for the better part of a century, even if we stop emitting carbon into the atmosphere right now. Sea level will continue to rise for centuries, potentially for a time period as long as a millennium, because of the very slow process of that surface heating slowly sinking into the ocean. And you know, as water is heated, it expands like other substances. And so the ocean will continue to expand for centuries, and sea level will continue to rise for centuries. The ice sheets, it turns out, also have a lot of that inertia. Once you set in motion the warming of the surface of the ice sheet and the beginning of the melting process, that sort of becomes a self-reinforcing process, and that can continue for centuries. And so right now we are committing to very long-term climate changes from the carbon we're putting into the atmosphere right now. And that's what makes this issue one of, an ethical issue, in my view. We're committing future generations to changes in climate we haven't even seen yet.
Yeah, very well said. We're speaking with Dr. Michael Mann, climate scientist, professor, and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, and his new article in Scientific American should be on the stands right now, the March issue, March 18th issue, Why Global Warming Will Cross a Dangerous Threshold in 2036. It's online as well. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We are talking with Dr. Michael Mann, climate scientist, professor, director of Penn State's Earth Science Systems Center. MichaelMann.net is his website, M-A-N-N. And we were just talking, sir, about thermal inertia, about the fact that we're at 400 parts per million, but the world isn't yet as warm as it will be, even if we were to stop at 400 parts per million. We've raised the temperature of the Earth over the last 50, 60, 100 years. You correct me, whatever the number is. Roughly 8/10 of a degree Celsius, a little more than a degree and a half or a degree and a third Fahrenheit. How much more of that warming are we already committed to if we were to stop emitting carbon right now? And will that push us to or beyond that 2-degree point that everybody's so worried about?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so this is the procrastination penalty that we often talk about with climate change, that the carbon we're putting into the atmosphere right now will guarantee warming of the surface of the planet for decades, and it'll guarantee the warming of the oceans and sea level rise for centuries. And thus far, the globe has warmed probably closer to about 0.9 degrees Celsius. And we've probably locked in, our best estimate is, that committed warming, the warming that's already in the pipeline because of the inertia of the climate system, that's probably close to 0.5 degrees Celsius. So we're somewhere close to 1.5 degrees Celsius in terms of the warming we've already committed to. And so if we're trying to avoid that 2 degrees Celsius warming limit, you can see how little wiggle room we have left. We're working with 0.5 degree Celsius. And indeed, that is why we need to bring our carbon emissions to a peak now and begin ramping them down by several percent a year if we are to avoid crossing that 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degree Fahrenheit threshold, often considered the threshold of truly dangerous and potentially irreversible climate change.
Now, these numbers and statistics and this information that you've been sharing with us up to this point is relatively uncontroversial, at least within the scientific community. Let's talk about the solution side of it, where there's a lot of controversy, not necessarily in the scientific community, but the solutions are not going to come about because a scientist says, okay, here's the prescription, go fill it at your local power plant. They're going to be political. They're going to be economic. They're going to be business solutions. What, in your opinion, are the things that we should be doing to prevent a climate disaster, frankly?
Well, there's so many things that we could be doing that are no-brainers. I mean, we ought to be doing them anyways. Whether it's, engaging in activities, the way we travel, go to work or school, using public transportation or bicycling rather than driving a car. Hey, it makes us healthier. It saves us money and it helps reduce our carbon emissions. Being more efficient with our use of energy, recycling, reusing materials, all of those things reduce our carbon footprint, and typically they make us happier, healthier, and they save us money. So they're, low-lying fruit. I mean, we ought to be doing it anyways. And it turns out that if everybody were sort of engaged in those sort of no regrets actions that are easy enough to do, save us money, reduce our carbon footprint, we could probably make a pretty big dent in the problem. But the problem is we can't fully solve the problem by, voluntary measures alone. We need some sort of, incentive structure through, government policies that incentivize clean energy, renewable energy, that at the very least level the playing field. I mean, right now, look what we're doing. We're, providing subsidies to dirty fossil fuel energy sources that are degrading the climate and the planet, and we're not investing enough in renewable energy. And so we have this completely unlevel playing field. If we could at least level the playing field by, you know, removing some of those fossil fuel subsidies, then all of a sudden renewable energy would be far more competitive in the marketplace. You know, the market can solve this problem. And I agree with some of my, you know, conservative friends that there's no reason that the market, you know, that a market solution to this problem can't be found. The issue is making sure that the playing field is level so that the market is operating on fair terms. And right now it's not.
Well, in a very real way, one of the few industries that doesn't pay to take out their trash is the fossil fuel industry. I mean, you know, we empty our waste baskets here and we pay for that. We pay to have our trash taken out. I do where I live. Most of us do. The concept of paying to take your trash out is not revolutionary, radical, or controversial. And yet the trash that the fossil fuel industry is releasing into the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases and particulate matter and the leakage, methane leakage from fracking and whatnot, they don't pay anything for any of that. And yet all of us are paying for it in the form of flood insurance taxes and FEMA and Sandy and dead people and everything else. What's an appropriate price for that trash? What's an appropriate price for a ton of carbon emitted?
Yeah, it's a great point and a great question. And, you know, my good friend Bill McKibben, I think, has sort of characterized this very well. We've given the fossil fuel industry the greatest subsidy ever imaginable. They are literally allowed to dump their waste into our atmosphere at no cost. How can that be possible? And here's the irony. If you look at ExxonMobil's sort of long-term strategy, economic plan, in some of the documents that you know have become available recently, there was a great article in the New York Times by Coral Davenport, a reporter, an environmental reporter at the New York Times, some months ago, where she found that in ExxonMobil's long-term business plan, they are assuming a cost of emitting carbon of $60 per ton.
Wow. The
damage is $60 damage done to the planet for every ton of carbon released into the atmosphere. That means ExxonMobil has a higher estimated rate of damage by fossil fuel burning than the Obama administration, because the administration's estimate of that number is almost a factor of two smaller. ExxonMobil has a larger estimate of the damage of fossil fuel burning to the economy and to the
absolutely
planet.
Amazing. Dr. Michael Mann, you can read all about it over at his website, michaelmann.net, and his new article in Scientific American in the March 18th issue of Scientific American, Why Global Warming Will Cross a Dangerous Threshold in 2036, his book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Dr. Mann, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor, sir. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Got ideas on what we can do with this mess? I think, you know, I agree with Michael Mann, carbon tax. Now, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're going to play Jimmy Carter. Actually, before I play this, let me set this up, because we have time to do it now, right? No? Not much. Okay, I get right to it. A couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, the LBJ Library released an audio recording of Lyndon Johnson talking with Everett Dirksen about how in 1968 they had negotiated peace with South Vietnam. They were going to end the Vietnam War, and the Nixon campaign was blowing it up. Here's the tape.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
So, with that in mind, I interviewed Jimmy Carter earlier today, and here's my conversation with him.
I'm very pleased to welcome back to our program the man that I consider the best president of my lifetime, Nobel Peace Prize winner, one of our world's genuinely great statesmen, President former President Jimmy Carter. He has a new book out called A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. President Carter, welcome back to the program.
Tom, it's good to be on with you and all folks all over the country.
Thank you so much. Before we get to your book, which I have read most of, and I think it's absolutely brilliant, I have an unrelated question about American politics.
Okay.
Do you mind if I ask that, or would you prefer
I don't mind.
It's okay?
Yeah.
About three or four years ago, the LBJ Library released tapes of LBJ working with Everett Dirksen trying to stop the Nixon campaign in 68 from blocking LBJ's peace deal with South Vietnam. They were not successful, and Dirksen called what Nixon did treason, and that those tapes are now available. President Bonnie Sauter has said that something similar happened to you during the Reagan campaign, and George W. Bush was only president because of the intervention of the U.S. Supreme Court, something you've commented on in the past. I'm wondering, you know, have we had a legitimately elected Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower?
Well, I think so. I wouldn't want to comment on that. That's pretty gross. But, yeah, I think we've had a legitimate elected president. I don't think that George W. Bush won the election in 2000 against Al Gore, because I think he probably lost Florida and also that nationwide. But, you know, when the Supreme Court rules in our country, that's what we have to accept.
Yeah, I absolutely. In your book, your book is so extraordinary, and I just want to strongly encourage all of our listeners to pick this up. It's a short, easy read, and it's so solid, a call to action. Early on in the book, in page 35, you talk about how America has dropped the ball, how incarceration, for example, you said when I was president. You're talking about now, you know, there are now five times as many American inmates in federal, state, and local prisons as when I was president. The number of incarcerated black women has increased by 800%.
That's correct. Yes, in fact, when compared to when I was governor, there's seven and a half times as many people in prison now. We've gotten to be a punitive society rather than a rehabilitative society. And we also have the only death penalty, as you know, in this hemisphere in NATO. And those things, I believe, are excessively violent, and they don't depend on making people better if they do make a mistake in the law. And there are about 3,200 people in this country now who are in jail for a life sentence that have never committed any crime of violence. They're there for drugs and so forth. So this is what we are doing in our country, and I think it sets a bad example for demonstrating violence in other aspects of our life.
As a Christian, you quoted a conversation you had with, I believe it was an Orthodox Christian, or was it the Vatican? I'm sorry, I read it. I don't have it right in front of me.
Okay.
Where they talked about how man was created first, but then with the, in the Christian context, men and women are created equal, basically, through baptism.
Yes.
And that you see that as a really good sign in that realm. Could you speak to that and also to the later story that you told about how the King of Morocco came back to the White House and spoke with your mother and how he's opening up Morocco to women? You mentioned Saudi Arabia, some of these countries that we think of as very restrictive, and in many ways they are, how the Muslim world is changing as well.
Well, I think the Muslim world is not to be condemned because, as I mentioned, a whole lot of maybe about 20 countries in the Islamic world that have very honest and fair elections. In fact, the largest Islamic country in the world is Indonesia, where we've had two elections that the Carter Center monitored. And in Morocco, the young king who came to visit me at the White House when I was president, he was just a boy then, has made the most profound changes or reforms in their laws in Morocco than any other country in the Islamic world as far as guaranteeing women equal rights. And this is a very encouraging thing. But I wouldn't say that the Quran has any worse verses in it about women's rights than does the Holy Bible. In fact, it's hard to find a verse in the Quran that really says that men are superior to women. Almost invariably, the verses say that they're both created equal in God's eyes. But in the Christian church, of course, and in the Old Testament, you can find some selected verses that say the opposite thing. But I teach the Bible every Sunday in my little home church in Plains, and I know that Jesus Christ was a preeminent champion of women's rights in his lifetime, and maybe the champion of all times. So when I get into a quandary about a particular verse in the Bible, there are about 36,000 of them, I just go back and read what Jesus did and said, and it reassures me about women's rights.
Mm. I'm curious your thoughts on population. I didn't see much discussion of it in the book, although, as I mentioned, I've only read about three-quarters of it. I wrote a book back in 96, Last Stars of Ancient Sunlight, citing a bunch of research that showed that if you want to stabilize population, it's not even a matter of access to birth control. It's a matter of political and economic power for women, that when women are empowered, they will control family size.
That's exactly right. If you educate girls and women and give them an equal chance in the society, then almost immediately the number of children that they bear drops down. There's a direct relationship between economic progress, and particularly with women, and the small size of families. And we found that we have had programs in about 80 countries around the world, and we found that in every place we've had a major health program.
That as women have power and control over themselves, that their family sizes decrease.
Yeah, and when they know the children are going to live. You know, when they give the children better sanitation, when they give them better diet and so forth, and give them a rudimentary opportunity for better health care, if they realize that their children are going to live, then they don't have as many children as they can. Another thing that happens is that when you convince a community that the girls can get educated and be just as productive when you're an old parent as your son can, maybe even more attentive to her parents, then, of course, you stop the genocide, or gendercide, I call it, of little girls when they're born.
Yeah. It's very easy for us to look at third world nations or other countries and religions and wag our finger at them. But one of the points that you make in the book, and so very eloquently, you talk about not just the Equal Rights Amendment, but the Violence Against Women Act, and then immediately in the next paragraph, how there were a number of prominent politicians and people like Phyllis Schlafly who condemned it. What is your prognosis for women's rights here in the United States? We still have not passed the Equal Rights Amendment.
It's horrendous. We rank 78th in the world in equal pay for women. 77 other countries are above us. We rank 70th. In the number of women who hold public office at the local, state, and level, national level. We have one of the worst sexual trafficking or slavery programs in America, particularly for young girls. The State Department last year estimated that there were 100,000 girls sold into slavery in America every year. Atlanta's the number one trading post for young girls being sold into slavery because we have the largest airport in the world, and we import a lot of our passengers from the Southern Hemisphere, where girls that a pimp wants to buy or a brothel owner wants to buy are much more cheap than the girls in the Northern Hemisphere. So we have all of these kinds of abuses, not only in what I've just mentioned, but also in the military and in almost every university in America. We have sexual abuse that's not really punished or even brought to the public's attention.
We have just another minute of our interview with President Jimmy Carter. But we're just about out of time here. What do we have? 10 seconds. Okay. I also want to play, I've got these two clips from July 15th, 1979, when President Carter was President Carter. And I meant that entirely sincerely when I said I think he was one of the best presidents of my lifetime. And where he was talking about the energy crisis, to bring this back to our conversation with Michael Mann. So when we come back from the break, I will play my last question to President Carter and his last answer, and then these clips from 1979, and then we'll pick up some of your thoughts and calls on President Carter. Stick with me.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Jimmy Carter's new book, by the way, is titled A Call to Action. The subtitle is Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. Good. And welcome back. I'm going to take some phone calls here for a couple of minutes before our commercial stations rejoin us, and then we'll get back to the very end of the Carter interview. So, Dave, watching Free Speech TV in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on that speech that Jimmy Carter made in 1977. He basically started the Department of Energy, and it was really the most comprehensive energy policy speech. Anyways, you covered a lot of the points as far as the home insulation and more efficient cars and that sort of thing. But he did predict pretty much what would happen if we didn't start radically changing, and it has. It's all played out. He kind of predicted our involvement in the Middle East, what would happen if we kept doing what we were doing. And, he was really right on about that stuff. And I really admire him just for his, being a humanitarian and an honest person. I probably disagree with him on a few things, but I think he was really a great man. And,
yeah.
I'm really happy that he got him on TV today. It's really neat.
Yeah, me too. Thank you very much, Dave. Thanks for your kind comments. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Yeah, got some good news about climate change. We can give it the finger by simply using our fingers to flip off light switches. If you look right now, a typical coal-fired power plant's about 500 megawatts,
mm-hmm.
and you've got over a million listeners. If everyone just saved 200 watts, look around your house, you're probably wasting over 200 watts right now. You could close down. We could close down one nuclear power plant in one day.
That's two large light bulbs. I mean, two.
Each 100 watt light bulb puts out almost a ton of carbon dioxide a year, not to mention nitrogen dioxide, which is about 5 pounds,
wow.
and also sulfur dioxide, which causes acid rain. But if you look at just the bathrooms around the country, the public bathrooms that have like 500 plus watts of energy being used 24 hours a day, but they're only used 90%, 90% of the time, they're empty.
Right.
If we just turn off the lights in those, we could close down one coal-fired power plant.
So to get all Hayek about this, we need to change our incentive structure. We need to start charging for carbon. I mean, if a light bulb produces a ton of carbon a year, and carbon, Michael Mann thinks carbon should be priced at $60 a ton. Actually, on the TV show the other day, he said he thought $100 a ton, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's $100 a ton, a light bulb is going to emit a ton a year. Then that light bulb, instead of costing $2.35, should cost $102.35.
Yeah. But if we just give people the picture, too, of what it's costing. I mean, in my house right now, it's a two-person household with lots of computers and such, nice high-tech, use $27 worth of electricity a month.
Wow.
Without, without solar panels. And so it's...
So what are the things that you do to get your electricity down, other than just turning off lights when you're out in the room?
LED light bulbs.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when you go to buy a computer monitor, you'll see the variations on same size computer monitor could vary by fivefold the amount of energy it would use.
Right.
You can get big, computer monitors that use only 22 watts of energy versus 200 watts in some cases.
Right. That's mostly plasma versus LCD, isn't it?
Yeah. Even within LCD, you can find the wattage ranges by about 500%.
Wow. Jeff, I always learn something. Thank you for calling. Good talking to you. Yep, we'll catch up with you again soon. We'll be back with the end of my interview with Jimmy Carter and a clip of Jimmy Carter and more of your calls. Stick with me. Yeah. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And earlier today, I had an opportunity to talk with former President Jimmy Carter. He has a new book out. It's called A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. We played most of the interview with you. There's just a minute or so left of it. Here is the last question. So there seems in the United States and presumably all around the world a number of different leverage points, economic, political, educational, religious. Where are the areas to bring about equal rights for girls and women and empowerment of girls and women that you think are the most powerful and effective, as our last question here?
Well, one thing is for the United States Congress to ratify or approve the laws that have been passed by the United Nations General Assembly and also by the Security Council. There's a convention on the elimination of discrimination against women, CEDAW they call it, that the most other countries have ratified, including China and so forth, but the U.S. Senate refuses to ratify this this convention. And there's an International Violence Against Women Act that had been passed by most countries. Again, the United States Congress refuses to pass it. And so these are the things that block our country from taking a leadership role in the whole world in trying to reduce the abuse of women and girls.
Okay. President Jimmy Carter, his new book, A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. Sir, you are genuinely one of my heroes. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. President Jimmy Carter. Now, flashback, let's step into that. That was today. Let's step into the Wayback Machine. Back in 1979, this audio is coming out of my computer, Shano. Back in 1979, President Jimmy Carter sat down with the nation and said, we've got a problem, and we've got to do something about it. And, in fact, I'm going to do something about it. Keep in mind, he actually did the things he was going to say. He says in this speech he was going to do. Ronald Reagan came into office in January of 1981 and undid them all. But here's President Carter on July 15th, 1979.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one. I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
It was 35 years ago.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Which would have been 14 years ago. It's almost enough to make you want to cry, you know? I mean, had Bill Casey, who was Reagan made his CIA director, had Bill Casey not flown to Paris and cut a deal with the representative of the Ayatollah to hold the hostages, and this was in the midst of an election in that President Bonnie Sauter writes about in the Christian Science Monitor, March of last year. You can look it up. It's still online. A presidential election in Iran where the candidate who won with over 70% of the vote won on the platform of freeing the American hostages before the American election. And President Bonnie Sauter won the election. And in September of 1980, 2 months before the American election, where Carter versus Reagan, and Carter was ahead in the polls. And President Bonnie Sauter went to Ayatollah Khomeini and said, I want to fulfill my campaign promises and let the hostages go. And Khomeini said, you cannot do that because I cut a deal with the Reagan campaign. And it turns out that Robert Perry did some great reporting on this. This is no secret. That the Israelis were already delivering to the Iranians in September of 1980 tires, F-15 tires, spare parts for their military. Because their military, you know, we put the Shah into place. We overthrew the democratically elected president of Iran, and I think it was 1954. We put the Shah into place. And, you know, it, by the way, something that if you want to criticize Mr. Eisenhower for, President Eisenhower, and we put the Shah into place, and we supplied all his weaponry. And so, you know, the Reagan administration was supplying that to them. And so they held, and so literally the moment that the hostages were released in 1981, January of 1981, was the moment, to the minute, was the minute that Ronald Reagan lifted his hand to be sworn into office. Talk about a deal with the devil. And if I was that kind of Bible-thumping believer, I would think it was literally a deal with the devil. Because look at what has happened to this country since the Reagan presidency, since the re-election of Jimmy Carter was stolen from him by an act of treason by Bill Casey and the Reagan campaign. Not dissimilar, not different from the act of treason that was committed by LBJ, or excuse me, by Richard Nixon against LBJ. And, in fact, let me once again play the tape of that. This is Lyndon Johnson talking to Everett Dirksen. He's just discovered He had negotiated peace in 1968. Hubert Humphrey was running for president. He had just negotiated peace between North and South Vietnam and the United States, and Nixon comes in and blows it up. Here's the tape.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico. And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
This is treason. I know. So Nixon was elected by treason. Reagan was elected by treason. George W. Bush was appointed by the Supreme Court. I think my question to President Carter today stands. Has there been a legitimately elected Republican president since Eisenhower? In my opinion, the answer is no. Anyhow, we'll catch up with everything else tomorrow. Give us a call back. I know the lines are full here. A lot of people wanted to comment on these things. We'll pick it up tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.